Thank you very much for coming along. Thanks for LCA. I actually just realised that she's taken up my first two slides. I'll actually just do some preliminaries. I'm very, very happy to have people asking questions during my talk, hand up and things, and I'll do my best to repeat the question. Somebody wave their arm or something if I forget that. Also, if that gets to be too much questions and it seems to be disrupting the flow of the talk, then I will scale back on that, but I'll let you know. As mentioned, I am the main author of these two libraries. Secret Rabbit Code is more commonly known as LibSampleRate. And I'm currently a software engineer for a great little venture capital funded startup in Sydney. How did I get to be here is a really interesting question. I'd written a couple of libraries and I'd used a number of other libraries, and occasionally I'd find libraries that were just really difficult to use. One, I was doing image processing. I'm not going to name any names about particularly bad libraries. I'm going to praise where praise is due and just generally hint at problems where there might have been others. I had a task, relatively trivial task, where I had an image, I wanted to do a bit of scaling on it, and I wanted to put some text over the top of it. And I used one particular open source library and found that the documentation and the API was hellish. I spent about a day and got some of the way there, but it didn't get anything done. I then took a look at LibCairo, Keith Packard and some of the ex-hackers, and in 3 hours I had achieved everything that I'd spent a day doing with the other library. So the difference, it was effectively the same job with two libraries that were effectively supposed to do the same thing, and the results in terms of ease of use for me as a programmer was just miles apart. So this is where I think that, you know, library design should really be easy, and API design, which I'll get to in just a moment. It should really be easy, but the evidence on the ground seems to show that it's not. And that intrigued me, and I thought, gee, this is a great topic for a great little topic for a talk. Until I found out, and until I actually started looking at the problem and found out that it's not a little topic at all. It's a huge, great, big, ugly, hairy topic. So by necessity, this is going to have to be an overview, and a pretty general one at that. I will try and cover the bases and get a good general overview, but you're not going to come out of here designing brilliant APIs just because you've heard my talk. Unfortunately, I wish it would be that easy. The idea is that I would, coming out of here, I would hope that you might understand the process, and I've got some resources towards the end as well, that coming out of here you will at least understand what to be looking for in APIs that you're designing and have some ideas on how to improve it once you've decided that you actually do want to come out with an API. One of the real strengths of Linux and FOSS is the huge number of libraries that are available. When you consider all the, I mean, one only has to look at the Debian repositories where they collect them into pools and then A, B, C, D, and then L. You get to L, and then there's L, and then there's lib A, lib B, lib C, lib D, lib thousands of these libraries. And they're really nice because they're prepackaged, pre-compiled, reusable chunks of code that you can just drop into your programs. You don't have to recompile them. Well, apt-get and yum install or whatever. You don't have to recompile them. They're there, ready to roll, usually with some pretty good documentation. And I actually think that libraries provide the reuse that OO, object-oriented programming, has promised, but I personally think hasn't quite delivered the kind of reuse that libraries can provide. I just got a note here that the quality of these libraries varies immensely, and what I'd like to see is that by thinking about the problem some more, we can actually raise the the general level so that they can all be much closer to Cairo than they were to the other library that I had those struggles with. The real reason people use libraries is also important to consider. I mean, they use it to avoid doing nasty grunt work themselves. Things like decoding JPEG images on disk and getting them into a window, that's obviously something that's a real pain in the neck. People don't want to write their own JPEG encoders and decoders to handle JPEGs, for instance. They would like to get a nice, easy-to-use API that goes blah. Couple of calls, 5 to 10 library calls would be as much as you'd want to do with that. Drinking time. Libraries provide what is called an application programming interface. And they're actually a little bit more general in that any larger project will actually have internal APIs. So if you've got a larger project and it's going to be anything ever, it will have a quite modular structure. So there might be a part that talks to the network, there might be a part that talks to disk, and I'm thinking more audio streaming applications maybe, which is one of the fields I work in. In that kind of a situation, you'll usually design the networking code to be modular and provide a simple API to the rest of the program. In a similar way, libraries provide APIs so that rather than that piece of networking code or that file I/O code sitting in your own program, it sits in a discrete library. And basically the API is the software interface, the set of contracts which the client application interacts with the functionality provided by the library. Talking about libraries, you really can't escape the fact that languages will play a very big part in this. Most people who have been coding for a while, like was pointed out with me, having been around a while, most people who have been coding for a while will have touched more than one or two libraries. Until quite recently, I was probably programming in four languages every single week of the year. Now it's probably down to about three. I dropped one. I won't name names. And the way libraries work in the different languages is quite dissimilar. But there's actually naming names here, Java and C++, the libraries will usually be object-oriented and will work in a very, very different way to languages like C or OCaml, which is a functional language. So even though something like Java can be, or even say we'll actually do dynamic programming, so a language like Python, which is object-oriented and dynamically typed, and compare that to OCaml, which is a functional language and statically typed, although they operate in very, very different ways and the paradigms you use in programming them are very different, the underlying requirements on library design are still very, very similar for the most part. And because I realise I have sort of limited time in this talk, I'm going to take that sort of 10,000 foot view on this and not in general talk too much about specifics, as much as that might be. So I'll try to be language agnostic, but with languages you really must be if you are doing, and I suppose this is where I'm getting to my next slide here. Keep my train of thought. You need to think about where you're targeting your library. Obviously, there are some libraries you'll be writing which are specifically designed to be a Python library, to be called from within Python, and you really don't have any intention of it going beyond there, and that is perfectly fine. For certain kinds of bigger libraries, and I'm thinking things like libraries for reading and writing image files, audio files, video files, things like that, you would like to have, because they're very, very complex tasks to do those things, you'd like to have those libraries written in some base language that is very easy accessible from other languages. And I'm going to put it to you that that language would probably be C, and some people might call bias there, but C is a very nice lingua franca in that you can, all of the high level languages call into C very, very easily, and with languages like C++, often a single header file can be provide a nice object-oriented wrapper around a C API. So you, and then all the thing is you've got a C API with a C header file and then a C++ header file over the top of that, and you've got an object-oriented interface to a C library. Languages like Python and OCaml and Perl and things, you need more complicated interface to the C library, but if you do the C library design the right way, you can actually make the writing of bindings on top of that easier. And we'll be looking at that somewhere along the line. Your main goals when you're designing an API is to maximize the functionality you can provide to, actually even before that, I'll actually say you want to, your library is going to be addressing a particular problem space. You want to solve the majority of the problems in that problem space. You want to maximize the functionality available to the client of the library, but first and foremost, you want ease of use. If a library is too hard to use or too buggy, people will be tempted to replace it. And depending on how hard it is to implement the functionality will depend on how easily that happens. Really, really difficult things things that are very, very difficult to implement tend not to be replaced very quickly, although it did happen in the case of libcairo, replacing an earlier library that a lot of people were using. And there's actually one more. It actually astounded me when I released my first library to find that almost immediately I was getting a flood of email. The more things you get wrong in the API design, you'll get email regardless, but the more things you get wrong in the API design, the more email you will get. And if you get it really wrong, you'll probably end up with a flood. So it can actually, and especially as open source developers, if you're doing this thing in your spare time, your design can actually influence how much email you get. You'll get emails anyway. You want to hope that that's more of the stuff, this is great, it's so easy to use, thank you. Those ones are great. The ones where they're going, I really can't figure out this. What do I do with this function or method? It doesn't seem to make sense. That's a really good indicator that some time ago you made a mistake in the API design, and you've now got something that's going to be haunting you for some time. Like I said, ease of use is factor number one. If it's hard to learn, people might think it's easier to write themselves. There's a number of things like Cairo. I mean, I keep coming back on Cairo because that's one of those really nice examples which I use quite extensively. And I've actually used it both from C and from OCaml and actually from Python as well. And it's one of these libraries where you read the function names and you know what it does almost immediately. It's almost self-explanatory. It's also got fantastic documentation, which helps. And I think one of the strengths of Cairo is that it actually tends to bootstrap on top of knowledge you already have. So the actual function naming suggests to you what it does. And it does that in a very, very nice way. So for an example of trying to bootstrap on a user's existing knowledge, look at the standard C functions, fopen, fread, fwrite, and so on. If you're doing a library that reads and writes JPEGs or whatever, fopen, fread, fwrite, with some caveats which I'll get to later, are actually a good model to use. And using that model will mean that if you name your functions mylib open, obviously the open function, mylib read, it all becomes pretty obvious what it does. The flip side is that, of course, if you screw up and make it too hard. Oh, sorry. The flip side of easy to use actually is that it's also, you need to make it hard to misuse, because this is when you'll get the email that says, "I used your function call, and it didn't do what I expected it to." That's another one where you need to make it hard to do the wrong thing. I have an example of that later. And one final thing of the ease of use, which is actually probably the most common fault that I've seen, is actually that somebody produces an API which requires large amounts of boilerplate code to get to the actual functionality. Boilerplate code is code that looks almost exactly the same every time you do it. So every time you want to open a JPEG file or whatever, you have to do step A, step B, step C, step D, and then finally you can read your data. Another very common example is where you get some of those early steps in the wrong order, or you forget one and it doesn't work at all. If you do have to do A, B, C and D, see if you can find a way to push that down into the library itself so that there's actually A and then read the data. Maybe checking for a return value. Obviously, seeing into the future is somewhat hard. But with a bit of luck, your library is going to be around for a while. And if it is, and you're lucky, you will have prepared for the future. I'm assuming the people that are writing libraries that solve a problem are actually experts in that problem domain, so that they will have a good idea of what the future holds for them. And it's very easy to do sort of a library that has, on the first release, does a certain set of functionality, and then later that functionality gets extended with new function calls, new methods or whatever, without breaking the old API, but you get new functionality. You should be thinking about that on the first roll, so that the design of the API doesn't actually block things that you might like to add in future. And the main reason is that Rasta? Over time, the requirements on the library will evolve. You might start off with a library that reads JPEGs, and later on somebody releases this format called PNG that everybody seems to want to use. And you probably shouldn't have called it libjpeg, but maybe libimage might have been better or something, or libchira. Gee, that's a good name, but no. So you need to design for evolving design requirements, and almost certainly you need to design for other CPUs and other platforms. Back in 1990 or 99, when I wrote libsoundfile, I couldn't imagine that I'd be here sort of nine years later. But I think libsoundfile has stood the test of time, and it's still evolving. And that's the sort of thing you want to aim for your library, and hopefully one day I might even pass it off to somebody else. Finally, for thinking of the future, if you are actually writing a C library, you want to think that library is going to want to be wrapped in other languages. 1999, Perl was around, Python was around, I don't know, 0.9 or something, Anthony was saying this morning. Those things were around, but there weren't huge numbers of people using them for applications where they'd want to be pulling sound data in. But nowadays there is actually Python bindings for, and Perl bindings for libsoundfile. So although you may not want it now, if you can design your library so that bindings is easy, you get a free kick later on. So you've decided you want to design a library. Rule number one, I think, is having an implementation already is a really bad place to start. And I mean, people can laugh, but the particular library that I had all that trouble with was very definitely, you could see from the design, that it was an application that had been chopped in half or chopped in a very small chunk, which was the program, and then the rest went into a library. And the big mistake they made was that the implementation governed the API. You want to divorce completely any idea you have of the implementation until you know what the API is going to have a look at. Later on, the implementation can influence the API design once you come to implementation, but we'll get to that in just a moment. So I'm going to mention very briefly here a resource which I've got on the last slide. There's a Google video and a set of slides by a fellow named Joshua Block, who's a Googler, of course, and a Java guy who has an excellent set of slides and a video. He suggests that when you're gathering requirements, which is actually this very first step, when you're gathering requirements, you need to be skeptical. People will ask you for stuff that they're never going to need. So particularly in cases where you've been tasked with designing an API that's going to be used by a large number of people, they will ask for all sorts of crazy stuff that they're not going to use. So Josh says, be very skeptical. If you're writing your library as part of a bigger project, then you have a really good resource. A bunch of people who roughly know what they want and who you can bat ideas off with and get an idea of what you actually need. But if that's only one project, you're only likely to get the requirements for that project. And you need to be careful that you're not missing out on use cases that are perfectly reasonable for the problem domain you have, but are actually being ignored by the big project that you've got. Another tip for people setting out on this journey is Rusty Russell has something called the Interface Simplicity Spectrum. People aware of that? This is gold. In typical Rusty fashion, it is gold. He has a list of 17 API or interface characteristics or ways to measure an API. And at the very top, so it goes from 1 to 17, the top being the best, the very best API, the compiler or the linker won't let you get it wrong. Completely bulletproof. You get a compiler error if you get it wrong. That's the very, very best. Followed by the compiler will warn you, print out a warning message if you get it wrong. To the simplest way, the simplest use is the correct one. All the way down to number 17, which is it's impossible to get it right. Now, if you're designing an API, I really suggest that you Google Rusty's interface simplicity spectrum and print it out and tape it to your wall, because it is truly excellent. And that's the other resource, and that I've got links, not links to them, but I've got them on a final slide. So you've got a first pass of the API. Well, you're about to start a first pass of the API. Hopefully you don't have an implementation yet, but if you have got an implementation, you need to put that completely to the back of your mind. and actually write out the API. So in Java and C++, you'd write out the class or classes in a file each, a C header file. Python, probably just the actual class methods without an implementation. And you'd want to be using doc strings, Java doc or whatever. And your goal with this first turn of the API is simply to specify functions and methods and ways they interact and to document them. You would want this to be very, very small because you need to keep this in your head and you need it to bat it off other people. And if people see reams and reams of documentation, they're going to go, okay, that looks okay. Well, if it's small and compact, they've actually got a good incentive to really drill down and to really have a good look at it. Then what you don't want to do is you want to show your API to potential users and solicit comments, as many as you can find, as early as possible. And hopefully they'll come up with things like, fix things like naming conventions. Naming is really, really important because if you name your functions well, the use will be pretty obvious. If you name your functions badly, it's going to require people to read documentation, and there are libraries out there where you want to perform some sort of task, and you actually have to grep the whole documentation to find out the task, and it says, oh, that's the function that does it. That's the sort of thing that can go wrong when the function is so hard to find because the naming is simply completely screwy. The other things like consistent parameter naming and ordering. I'm allowed to pick on the C standard library, which I'll do here. fprintf and fputs, they're both functions that you're likely to use in the same program in the same place, and they both operate on this file star stream thing. And why is it the first parameter of the first function, the last parameter of the second one, and over here? What did they do? I mean, obviously this is screwy. There's simply no reason. There's very good reasons for it to be the first parameter in filelib because you've got a variable argument list at the end. That's a very good reason to have file at the front. It also sort of makes sense. It's a little bit like C++ where it might be stream.fprintf and then have the format after that. At the end, what were they thinking? Quite honestly. There's another really interesting one here too. If I hadn't named those size and n, if it had just been A and B, what would you have done? It's really nice, if at all possible, to... you've got to ask, why do they really need size and n? Because those two can easily be swapped around. And for people who know fread, if you get the size and the n swapped around there, the return value is not going to be what you expect it to be. Again, things that just go against your intuition are things to avoid. So when you're showing... Oh, here's another one. Mylib read and mylib write, and they both take a pointer to some sort of data. If you've got a write method, you probably want to make that take a const. This is C and C++ and Java and C# as well. You probably want to make the data that you're writing const, so that your function is const correct. It's an indication to the reader or the people who's reading the documentation that the data that you're passing to mylibwrite gets written, however it is, written to the wire, written to the disk or whatever, it gets written unchanged. Write will not modify the data, so that they have a guarantee that although they may be writing it there, they may want to write it somewhere else, but that they have this guarantee that the first write didn't modify the data. obviously a read, you want them to modify it because you're reading the data into the pointer pointed to by data. This is also fair game. I'm not going to bag out any open source libraries by name, but everybody knows that that comes from Windows. If you... Yeah. Yeah, there's some... Rafter, we're not picking on open source software today. We're trying to improve open source software today. If you write a function or a method like this with dozens of parameters, you probably need to think again. This is the sort of thing where, well, for instance, the middle four thing, the int x, int y, int width, and int height. To having four integer parameters like that, there are other functions in the Windows API that actually have the width and the height first, I'm pretty sure, and then you need to know which ones come first and which ones. So basically, every time you use that function, you need to look it up and find out what the real parameter list is and what it takes. I'll contrast that to a good example. So this is basically just two functions to draw a line. It's two functions. Ouch. But it does something really nice here in that if you're given a function that is draw a line and you that function takes four parameters, is that four parameters that go x, y, end x, end y, or is it x, y and a x length and an x width? Here, that is completely obvious. It's a start position, you move to a start position, and then you've got a line to an end position, unambiguous. And this is some of the stuff that really impressed me in Cairo. Funnily enough, oh yes, to have, so he's suggesting that position, a struct with a position, that can help as well. That in fact is would be a very good one for that, a very good solution for this is actually to have, if, and I mean, the Microsoft API has a rect struct for rectangles. Why isn't that a rect? You remove four parameters and it becomes unambiguous. These are the sort of things that it's really, really subtle, and usually it takes somebody else to point it out. This is why you're talking... Rasta.
Although, the counterexample to that is a lot of invention for drawing lines ever in the past small graphs. X1, X2, so X1, Y1, X2, Y2 in four parameters is convention in almost everything I've seen, and this would be very counter to the past. So as you were saying before, build on existing knowledge of what you've seen. This would be different, but it is obvious.
I'm going, okay, so Rasta's saying that it's actually a very common convention. Rasta's saying that it's very common convention to do x, y, x0, x1, for a line. Yes, but I actually know where Keith Packard got this. Well, no, he actually, this was inspired by PostScript. And so PostScript has this idea where it's a stack language. I'm a bit rusty on what PostScript even is, but it's a stack language, and it was postfix, so it has moved to X, Y, and then line to just like this. So that was, effectively, Keith Packard was building on that bit of knowledge instead of some other knowledge.
It's another one, but yeah.
So yes, Rasta's saying that choose your conventions, and what's more, I'd say keep consistent conventions. Don't mix your conventions is probably more important for a single API. Namespacing. There's a whole bunch of libraries out there who do this, particularly really old school Unix libraries, and I'd actually say, you know, standard C with F open, F read, F write. There's that one letter F which says, that sort of says this bit's to do with the file star stuff. Things like Rasta's Evis library, all of the API stuff is evs_name in C, where you don't actually have where you don't actually have C++ or Java style namespaces. Java has not. Yes, Java has namespaces. So namespacing, if you can use your in languages like C, which actually don't have namespaces, you can actually use all of your enums might start with you know the name a short name for your library. For libsoundfile, I've got sf soundfile name for all of the methods. All of the enums are sf or sfc or sfm name. So I've taken that namespace and that keeps it there. There's a number of libraries, and these are more the old school Unix libraries where the namespacing was just really, really bad. So there's methods like read, and is that POSIX read or is that read for this library? So once we come to validating with the design, this is where it gets really important. Again, it's time to really revisit Rusty's interface spectrum simplicity thing and to see if you can move any of it up the spectrum, because up the spectrum is better. If you can move from the compiler will give you a warning to the compiler will not compile your code, that's a huge win in that the warnings you can see, they can just rush past and you can miss them. If it goes error, you know, that's a huge win. The most important thing you're going to actually be doing is writing functional tests, actually. Now, I know in this day and age of everybody doing unit tests, people tend to drop functional tests. You need to unit test, that's very, very important, but functional tests is very, very important at the API design validation stage, because that's when you really get to tweak the buttons on the library to see if you've actually got the API design right. And not only writing functional tests, but you should actually be writing real programs, even if you've got a stubbed out implementation, just to see what it's like to step through the things to do regular tasks with this library. And from the library, from the requirements documentation, you should understand what you need to do, and you need to see how easy it is by simply writing simple little programs that, if the library worked, your program would work. And then implementation. It's at implementation time that you quite often get some other feedback, and it's important to avoid having the implementation at that stage negatively affect the API design, because it can. It can also have positive effects, and that's very much what you're looking for. If it's sort of a general thing, but the implementation stage is probably the most important stage, and it's when you get your implementation done and the API still seems sensible and your functional tests seem sensible and your toy program seems sensible, then you need to give it to some people. With libsamplerate, I had Conrad Parker to kick me, because I thought the whole thing of it's audio sample rate conversion, which is underneath the covers, is a really horrible operation to do. And because of that, all of that horror, I thought, I only want to do it for mono audio, one channel. And if people want to do more, they can instantiate some more. Fortunately, Conrad did annoy me and bitch and complain. And so I actually ended up so it can do up to a large number, in fact, as many channels as you like within the limits of what your memory will accept. So things like that, kicking it off those early adopter users or the people you'd like to have using your library can really, really help. Early on, we said that the aim for maximum functionality and maximum ease of use. Those can often be in real serious conflict, and Secret Rabbit Code is definitely one of those libraries where the operation underneath has some quirks that the API cannot really hide. And that's when you need to think, is multiple APIs the right way to go? So you can have a slightly more difficult to use API that actually does do everything, and then layer on top of that a really, really simple API that can do the simple use cases. That can be a huge win for your users in that they've got the simple API to work to while that suits their purpose, and then when they get their need to go beyond that, they have confidence in the library enough to go to the more full-featured and more difficult API.
Would you have different namespaces?
The question is, would you have separate namespaces? Depending on how big it is, above a certain size, I would recommend it even. I actually think it's and I mean, this is something that I've had to breeze over. Reducing the size of the API is very, very important, because people who are learning this need to understand how the whole thing interacts. And if your library has 1,000 or 100 function and method calls, there's no way they can hold that in their head while they're learning it and make progress quickly. If you can reduce that anyway, that really, really helps the user. So yes, I'd be hoping that the simple API drops things right down so there's maybe maximum of 10 calls. Obviously with things like GTK, which is huge, that's not possible, but I'm not going to rag on GTK, because I think that's working in a really, really difficult problem space, and I think it actually does quite a good job of it. Finally, error reporting, and this is actually one that's very, very difficult to get right. I can't really think of any useful task that a library could do where it would not have to report errors to the caller. I'm sorry? That's considered poor form, at least amongst people I know, yes. Again, yes. So yes, the suggestion was I could call abort on error conditions. That's generally not considered good form. Like I say, I would discourage that, but he's suggesting that it would be fun if the library calls abort and the library is being used inside the X server. Yes, that is a recipe for more pain than anybody should really have to put up with. Now, if I could do error reporting very quickly, because I am running out of time. People, I'm assuming there aren't very many questions, because I haven't had that many people putting their hand up. With error reporting, usually your library at some stage has to interact with users, so you need to provide a way of your library providing error messages that the client code can very easily pass to users. Strings are good for that, but strings are not very good for a whole bunch of other things. So in a C library, you may actually want to do things like have integer error numbers for programmatic reporting of errors, and then have a conversion function that converts an integer error number to a string for displaying to users. That's one. Lots of languages now have exceptions, and those should really be used for exceptional conditions. Do you use exceptions or not? C++, people may not want to use exceptions because the C++ exception mechanism is not as good as it is in some of the other languages, like, for instance, Python and OCaml, and probably won't put a Java in that. I don't know Java all that well. And so while you may want to use exceptions, it may not be the way you want to report all errors. I would think that exceptions really only should be used for exceptional conditions. Running out of memory might be a valid one, rather than abort an exception, but file not found, there may be a better way of reporting that.
Also to add, don't use
Oh, exactly, yes, that's a very good one. James suggests don't force your API design to force the user to use exceptions for flow control. That's considered very, very poor form. Language bindings. Gee, I would have loved to have talked about language bindings. And of course, this could be a talk all of its own. SWG, the Simplified Wrapper Interface Generator. Very important. You want your language bindings to map nicely to the language you're using. So if you've got, if you're wrapping a C library in Java, you don't want to have a C-style API. You want to match the Java idioms as much as possible.
Yeah, I'm just surprised with the structure of that documentation. What's your feeling on the related source of I love it. Like, I have so much work to do. Documentation is a real part, and it makes my life a lot easier.
Yep, OCaml.doc, Java.doc, Doxygen, all of those tools are fantastic. And I started a long time before those were really available, but any stuff that I'm doing nowadays, yes, I'm doing it. I'm being asked to wrap up. Do I have some questions? Okay, so I'll take a few questions now, and I think I'm basically done.